This piece was brought to you by Roberta's. Roberta'sPizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after a long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to HR and Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the executive director.
You basically are at this point. I've been MIA.
I'm the communications director, not the executive director. That's the executive director, Katie Mosman-Wadler.
Hey, guys.
I jumped right ahead. Like, I was jumping.
I know, but I haven't been on Happy Hour in weeks and weeks and weeks because
that's why I'm so excited that you're here.
I'm excited to be here. And we have a pretty exciting show today.
Yes, we do.
And I'm also supremely excited by this beautiful bottle of wine that has a harp on it, and it's shaped like an olive oil bottle. But Kat's chosen a really nice orange wine for us today, which yes. I'm going to read off the label. Cos Rami. It is from, it's IGP, from Italia.
Italia.
It just says Prodotto in Italia. I don't see where it's from, but it's really delicious. 2017 Rami, and pretty excited about it.
Should we do a little cheers?
We absolutely should. It's so nice to be back in the office, in the studio. Cheers. We have some very special friends joining us today.
Hold on.
Gotta lean to get that clink.
Gotta reach.
Our studio engineer today is Amanda Wang, making us sound great. Hi, Amanda.
Hello, hello.
And we have one of our, I mean, more new to me because I've been away, but reasonably seasoned now, amazing intern, Pauline Munch. Hey, Pauline.
Hello, hello.
But Pauline, say your last name the German way.
The right way.
The right way?
Munch.
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 Like München.
But Munch, I think Munch works better.
It works great for
food,
HRN.
For
yeah.
That's true.
Pretty perfect. Yeah. And we have also a really, really special guest joining us. You may have heard his voice on our Newark episode of Meat and Three. But Kat, do you want to give an introduction to our special guest today?
Our special, extra special guest today is Frank Mentisana, the founding director of EcoSpaces Education. Yes. But we're going to get more into it with Frank shortly, but I saw Frank last week at an event where he spoke on kind of the work that he's doing. And I was trying to explain to someone, I was introducing Frank and I said, he works with EcoSpaces Education, and tried to explain what they do. I said, Frank, am I right? And he's like, no, not really, but it's okay. So Frank, can you briefly describe EcoSpaces Education and the work that you do?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. This is a pleasure. And it's always nice having a glass of wine in hand. So EcoSpaces really is kind of our version of a solution to childhood food-related illnesses, and the concept of bringing food-related education to students in schools and in communities to get them to start connecting to food in really healthy ways, right? So we do that in the school day, most especially, by aligning activities related to food, most especially gardening and cooking, with children, and bringing that into the school day so it aligns with curriculum that they're already having to do and are being tested upon. So that's the very short answer of what we do.
It's very it's a holistic approach, and so it has lots of different aspects to it, and we're gonna get more detailed with it that in a little bit.
Excellent.
First, we have a couple announcements and headlines. One announcement we want to shout out is that next week, Jimmy Carbone is bringing back the Brisket King of New York City. It's returning for its 8th year on April 10th at Biba of Williamsburg, which is here in Brooklyn. Brisket King, if you're not familiar, brings together 20 chefs, pit masters with all-inclusive craft beer, hard cider, and spirits. They will crown a Brisket King at the end of it. There are celebrity judges, two of which will be our very own hosts, Zara Tangora and Breton Scott of Life's a Banquet.
Or Zara Tangora.
Tangora.
And Breton Scott.
If you haven't listened to Life's a Banquet yet, do yourself a favor. Go listen. It is a roller coaster of hilarity every single week. This week they had an old friend of mine, Robbie Nelson, on the show to talk about hangovers. And I think he's a good person to talk about it because he has given me several hangovers in my life. First at Booker and Dax, where he was a bartender. And later on at just house parties where he brings bottled martinis. It's dangerous.
Danger.
But he used to work for Plymouth Gin, so he was the master of martinis.
I want to do a little trade with him with my wine bottled margaritas and his bottled martinis.
This is really good to segue into our headlines because our first headline is about batching cocktails. So let's go for it. On this week's episode of The Food Scene, drinks writer Maggie Hoffman talks about the art of batched cocktails just in time for spring. You can pick up a copy of Batch Cocktails, her most recent book, and learn how to mix up your own make-ahead pitcher. So get the book, listen to the podcast, get ready for batching cocktails this summer.
And I'm going to add something that's actually not the headline I'm supposed to say right now, because I'm going to get to that, but related to the events, because batched cocktails and spring make me think about picnics, which make me think about Central Park, which makes me think about an event that I'm going to on Saturday morning that's open to anybody at 9:30 in the morning on Saturday. I know, hangovers, 9:30. It happens. It's real. But incredible opportunity to forage in Central Park with wild man Steve Brill, who you may have heard on some of our programming here at HRN. It's going to be super fun. I will be there with bells on to like eat some stuff that we find in the park, and I would do this with no one other than Wildman Steve Brill. So for tickets, you can visit the New York Women's Culinary Alliance page, and there are definitely still tickets available for members and non-members. I hope to see you there. Okay, so I'm going to make a shift. We're going to talk about what happened on Speaking Broadly this week. So a couple weeks ago on Life's a Banquet with Zara and Breton, we had a crossover episode featuring Dana Cowan, where they talked about coffee. And this week on Speaking Broadly, we did the other crossover, where Zara came on Speaking Broadly with Dana to talk about how she recovered her sense of purpose after a horrific bus crash launched her off of a 40-foot cliff. This really happened. After the accident, Zara decided to change her career not once, but twice, to become first a wildly successful chef and now a radio host on Life's a Banquet here on Heritage Radio Network.
And lastly, we have a little teaser for you. This week's upcoming Meet and Three episode is bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures, from sourdough starters to shipwrecked beer. Meet travelers hunting the globe for endangered dishes and rescuing unique flavors from obscurity. I'm really excited about this one.
And you know I'm really into yeast, so there might be a little like yeast appearance in this show.
Yeast puns?
Check it out.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, it's a really, really fun one.
They're budding.
Yeah.
Puns.
It's okay.
Good one, Katie.
You can kick me out. It's fine. If you love puns, listen to Modernist Breadcrumbs.
Yes.
If you need more yeast and bread puns in your life.
Yes.
All right, cool. So we jumped around a lot, but everything's so connected these days.
I'm just so excited to be back.
Yeah. I'm glad to have you back.
Thank you.
All right. So back to our interview with Frank. Frank, we got to visit Phillips Academy, Phillips Charter Academy. Is that right?
It's Phillips Academy Charter
School. Phillips Academy Charter School. And one of the coolest things we got to see, in addition to the dining room and the garden, was a very huge picture on the wall of the one and only heroine of the world, Michelle Obama.
Indeed.
How did Michelle Obama come to visit Phillips?
So clearly she was kind of in the thick of her Let's Move movement, which aligned perfectly with everything we were doing. I also work and have for the past 6 years with Food Corps, which is an extension of AmeriCorps. And we had a Food Corps service member in our, you know, I have to go back. I think it was a matter of everything aligned, right?
Yeah.
So we were doing work that she was advocating for, obviously. We were working with Food Corps very closely, in fact. Her alliance with Food Corps was really direct. And we had just had a visit from the Department of Agriculture, the secretary from the Department of Agriculture, and the USDA. So there were just kind of a lot of things that happened. So I don't really know how it happened.
That was all. That was like all secret vetting. Like
totally, and everyone takes credit for it, right?
Oh yeah, of course.
They're like, she wouldn't have been here if it wasn't for me.
Totally.
But the bigger point is that I think that, like all of this, working together and collaborating really kind of brings a pretty clear message. And I think that we happened to, like, our stars were in the right place at that night.
That's so cool. So there's the picture of her, like, holding the worm. Can you tell us about how that, like, came to be,
sure.
Specifically that moment?
Yeah, I mean, that is my absolute favorite picture of the day, which is why it's blown up. Like, it's an 8 feet by 10 foot blow up. So there is a little story behind that. So she is actually holding live worms because the students at the time were talking about composting and showing her. She was on the rooftop garden, so they were showing her to plant, and she was painting garden signs, and they were talking about vermicomposting. And so my backstory, which I thought was always fun, is that they, her handlers basically put garden gloves throughout the garden. I mean, they were just like, she is not going to touch dirt. She's not going to touch anything. So these are her worms. And she just jumped in there with the kids and she picked up a worm with her bare, very manicured fingers and just kind of dispelled the whole belief that she needed to wear garden gloves. But it was an amazing, amazing, amazing day.
I just love that. She's like so hashtag relatable.
Completely.
In that moment.
I think she's such an icon of bravery because, yes, as you know, I am terrified of worms, even though I love gardening. So I really am just like, wow, she is tough.
Yeah, completely.
I already knew that, but just like as if I could admire her anymore.
Totally.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Yeah, that was definitely, out of the years I've been doing what I'm doing, and even in the food world, that's definitely the highlight of my life, I think.
Yeah, I'd say. Well, let's work backwards, because I mean, that's like a real pinnacle of, like, you know, accomplishment to you and to everyone that works with you. But how did this all start? How did you get involved in EcoSpaces education? I mean, how did you start it?
You know, I ask myself that question all the time. All the time. I'm like, so I...
Well, talk about, too, like, what you were doing before that.
Yeah. So I was completely entrenched in the food world. I went from food in the hotel business to being an entrepreneur. I owned a small business down in Soho called Once Upon a Tart for many, many years. So three owners later, sadly, just this past year, after 26 years, I think, it closed down, which in New York, I think, is...
That's a long run in New York.
Like, going through a wave right now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
In the East Village, for sure. Like, a lot of favorite places are just disappearing.
It is really hard. But, you know, I was actually speaking to the last owner and found out what the rent was compared to the under $1,000 rent I had in the early 1990s.
Oh.
And it's, you know, have to sell a lot of tarts or something.
It's a lot of tarts. Yeah.
to make that happen. So I segued from that into, I wrote a cookbook and photographed it based on Once Upon a Tart, which was super fun. And then realized, like, wow, there's a whole world out there where I don't have to cook every day for hundreds of people, but I could still be in food. So it kind of led me into food publishing. And that was kind of a nice thing, because after 10 years of doing, you know, being with Once Upon a Tart, I had known a lot of people from Martha Stewart, Food and Wine, Gourmet, all those people. So it was kind of nice to be able to kind of segue somewhat easily, I would say, into being a food stylist for a while. And then I met this woman at a party, and after some time talking about food, et cetera, she said, you have to meet my husband, who is a head of a school in Newark, New Jersey. So I live here in Brooklyn, but I thought, why not? You know, it sounds good. I had been following Alice Waters for a very long time and thought, wow, this is kind of an opportunity that could be interesting. So I went to see the school. I walked into their lunch period where they were serving just bad food, you know, just bad school food. And the good thing is that the school leader, the administrator, knew it was bad. Like they knew they needed some work. So they hired me as a consultant to bring in a food program. So with that, we brought in a made from scratch food program, which continues to live to this day, which you guys saw a little bit of. I think you even had a little taste of
it. We got to eat lunch.
We can totally vouch for it.
Yeah, right?
For school lunch? I was so blown away. We're going to come back and talk more about school lunch because I have a lot of things I want to cover with you.
Yeah.
But just to say,
hot topic today,
it's incredible now. You would not go in there and think that there was, you know, anything wrong with the lunch.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. And I think that's a big foundational piece to what we're doing. Probably the harder piece regarding change and where do we go with this? But the other piece is, I realized very quickly, partly through following Alice Waters, but also realizing like I have a kid myself and I've been around kids and realize you just can't say to a kid like eat this lettuce because it's really good for your body. It's like, you know, even that notion of like spinach is good for you and it makes you smarter. It doesn't really work. Right. So what I propose in this conversation is that we look at it kind of more holistically. Mm-hmm. Like we're not just going to bring in a made from scratch lunch program. We're going to connect kids to food, right? And we're going to do that. And we're going to garden and we're going to cook. And in the beginning I was very, very hands-on and I was really passionate about it. I love teaching kids how to cook most especially. And then families, like I was really kind of hot on that idea of getting kids and families to cook together. And then, I don't know, it just kept evolving into the next thing. Like, how do we teach them more? How do we make this more holistic? How do we, you know, these are urban kids. How do we bring in urban farming as opposed to just traditional, traditional farming? So over the course of years, I really thought I was going to be out of there in 8 months. I was a consultant. I was going to move on. And, you know, 9 years later, I kind of run this program that doesn't exist only in that school. We're in other schools. We produce conferences for educators to kind of get them to bring that information back. I don't know how much you want to hear, but our newest initiative is something called the Mobile Food Lab, which brings food literacy education to schools via this mobile field trip. So it's an old school bus that we had converted to a science. Inside there's a science lab, there's a kitchen, and there's an art station, and they all relate to food. And we pretty much travel around with our food educators and bring these field trips to schools. So there's a lot going on right now.
Yeah. So Frank, we initially got connected through Marco Shima via Arrow Farms. So right. Our listeners know Arrow Farms is an incredible indoor vertical farm. It's the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely amazing. And it's sort of a similar model to hydroponics, which you might be familiar with, but involves sort of a misting technology. So it uses even less water.
Exactly.
But tell us about how you got connected with Arrow Farms and how that's factored into the program at Phillips.
Yeah, that was, you know, another stars aligned. So the city of Newark, although I've seen a lot of incredibly positive change in the past 5 years, I would say 10 years, the connectivity to food and health was somewhat non-existent. I mean, it existed, of course, but Cory Booker actually had a sustainability director working with him, and she had this idea that she would create a food policy council. And in that conversation, which I was a part of, there was a suggestion that everyone interested in food throughout the city come together to meet. And it was just basically just getting out to your network saying, on this day, we're going to all meet at 10 o'clock and let's see where it goes. Well, it was the most incredible turnout. I mean, we couldn't fit in the room. It was packed. It took I think we were there for like maybe 2.5 hours and we were going to have a conversation, but it took 2.5 hours to introduce each and every one of us.
Wow.
So it's amazing.
Did you say
right?
like what year this approximately happened?
So probably 9 years ago,
okay.
maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I had pretty much just been starting EcoSpaces. And anyway, so there were farmers there. There were urban farmers there. There were not so many education people, but really ran the gamut. And the inventor, if you will, Ed Harwood, who was still part of the Aero Forum's team, was there, and his team was there, and we connected. And I just happened to be at a point where, as I was saying earlier, I was thinking about how do we bring garden education to kids in urban settings when typically they don't have backyards and they don't have kind of access to dirt, basically. So I was already in research mode, looking at, as you said, aquaponics, hydroponics, aeroponics, etc. And I happened to meet them, and they exactly at that moment were looking for a Newark location to house their first garden unit or farm unit, coming down from Ithaca, New York, where Dr. Harwood worked with Cornell. And I was like, you know what, this is perfect. I am looking for this, and you're looking for me and a space. So we actually brought it in, and we brought it into the cafeteria, and almost 9 years later, it's still there growing produce, completely student run, which is the important part for us, right? So the idea of producing food is really important, but the fact that the kids are learning and it's connected to their science curriculum and so on is really important. So, and then Aero Farms, you know, as you know, is the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
Yeah.
And it happens Crazy. To be in Newark, right?
And if you've ever had the dream greens from Fresh Direct or Whole Foods or anywhere,
that you don't have to wash.
They are incredibly delicious. You might not have until recently maybe made the connection that dream greens equals Aero Farms, but
right.
now inside their packaging you can see a photograph of their production facility, which is just mind-blowing. But Frank, going back, so you have the prototype Aero Farms unit, which is so cool.
Isn't that cool?
It's yeah. rad. Can you just describe visually what it looks like?
Yeah, as I say, and you know, Aero Farms probably, well, I think they'll be okay with this, but I probably go out to Home Depot right now and build it,
uh-huh.
except for a few things, right? Like, so most especially, there's a patented cloth that allows the seeds to germinate and the root systems to go into the cloth down, obviously, and the plant go up into the light system. And it's something that we reuse over and over and over. But it really is a basin of water with PVC piping and a water pump and some misting systems mm-hmm. in between. So I don't mean to make it sound so simple, but the fact is it's that prototype compared to where they are right now.
Yeah.
Because they in essence are a technology company. I mean, there's mm-hmm. no question that they've brought technology into their farming, and I think that's the incredible piece that has brought on the most current version of Aero Farms. And for
and
me,
it's a pretty big like rig. It's like taller than me.
It's huge. Yeah.
How like 10 feet long?
Yeah. It's like, it's probably 12 feet long and we have only two stacks.
Uh-huh.
So it's bigger than every single kid in the school.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so. And when I was calling Mark Oshima, cause we did a piece on Aero Farms as well as, EcoSpaces for Meat and Three.
Mm-hmm.
And I was calling him just to fact check something. And I said like, is it true that the Aero Farms prototype is in Phillips Charter Academy? And he was like, it's not a prototype. It's what it is.
It's
just two layers of what they have, 10 layers of in uh-huh. their farm now.
Right. Exactly.
That's really fascinating. I mean, you're using the exact same technology that they are using still today.
Completely.
And talk about like how much harvest you're getting from this one unit.
Yeah, so I would say if you asked me that question a few years ago, I could give you actual numbers.
Uh-huh.
but we took a step back and said, what is the purpose of this? Are we trying to produce really high yields, or are we trying to teach? And we realized that we're trying to teach. So with that, like farming, and we do traditional farming on the roof in that particular school. With that comes all the trials and tribulations of farming. So when the harvest doesn't really succeed, that's part of the learning process. So to be perfectly honest, we've kind of stopped tracking how many pounds, but we absolutely, between purchasing directly from Aero Farms, we definitely supplement the salad bar for 460 kids a day. And they go to you were there. Like, yeah. They definitely go to the salad bar.
Because they have their, like, family-style food, and then they are able to go to the salad bar.
Yes.
And can you tell us about the arugula salad dressing?
I can, but as you know, I can't tell you the secret recipe.
I know, but
but we're going to keep giving you wine and trying.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't even know the recipe, believe it or not. And, you know, and she's on my staff. But, So what happened in the very beginning? Right now, we grow lots of different things, and they try different things, and they try herbs and cilantro and basil. But in the very beginning, we were just growing arugula, like just straight arugula. And we were testing water for pH levels to see how pH levels affected taste, whether it be nuttiness or bitterness and so on. So we spent an enormous amount of time with an enormous amount of arugula crop, and we couldn't really kind of get through it. So one of our people on our culinary team, Miss Vanessa, decided she would try some recipe development. And so a little backtrack. So everything we do at that particular school is made from scratch cooking. So all of the vinaigrettes and dressings, et cetera, are all made from scratch. So she has the kind of flexibility to kind of do whatever she wants. So she just started kind of playing around, and we did a lot of taste tests, and it kind of became kind of a hit with the kids. Partly because, and this is the idea, right? When a kid grows arugula, they're going to eat arugula. And when they grow it, they're going to make a vinaigrette and try it on their, you know, so it's all kind of, that's the holistic piece. That's the piece that just works kind of very simultaneously. So that arugula dressing has been on the salad bar for a very long time at this point.
I just thought it was so cool that the arugula was like itself the dressing. I just thought that was like a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
It's very meta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Totally. Whoa.
So the thing that blew my mind when we walked into lunch, we were there. How old were the kids? Like 8-year-olds?
So in that particular school, actually all of our schools are the same. So from pre-K, which is 4-year-old up to 8th graders, which is somewhere around 13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lovely age.
They only get lovelier.
Yeah.
And all the lunch periods function more or less the same. The one that we walked in on, I mean, just like imagine yourself, you walk up to any school, you walk in during like 8-year-old lunchtime. What does that look and sound like? I mean, you just brace yourself, right? You're like, there's going to be food flying around. Everyone's going to be yelling and screaming and running around. And like the food's going to be like total crap. And what we actually walked into was like a beautiful, calming, orderly space with like not the long tables with the seats that are like fixed in one place that you imagine, but like round tables with settings, and every kid has a job at every table, and they set the table services family style. They're all really, really focused on what they're doing, and they're focused on the food, and they serve each other the food, and they all eat the food, and the food is made out of actual food. And it just was incredibly transporting, and not what you think of when you're like, I'm walking into, you know, New Jersey school lunch.
Right.
So sort of at what point did you feel like it was possible to change, like, not only the food of lunch, but the entire culture around kids eating lunch?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was my goal from day one. So I set the bar really high, and the CEO of Philips, Miguel Brito, was very down with this idea, you know. So and it's been amazing because he is an educator and comes from education, and so has really kind of let me fly with ideas. So setting the bar, going, this is how we want to do it, and obviously I didn't make it up, right? Like the round table comes from whatever boarding school or a kibbutz or you know summer camp or any of those kind of things. But the culture that it creates was really important and really important to me. And having had come from a food background and cooking for years, I also thought it was important to kind of elevate the whole notion of like who does cook the food? We want professionals to do this because they actually know how to do it, and they know how to do it within a budget, and they know how to make it tasty, because we need to make it tasty if we want kids to eat it. So it was just combination of wanting professionals to cook real food that was tasty, and having really high expectations of what we could do, and the students, and surely as you saw, like, that's no joke. They were, you know, they go to the salad bar, they pay attention to what they're doing, they set the tables with forks and plates, and they serve themselves, and mm-hmm. So it's I think your reaction is very much a similar reaction to most everyone who comes in there, because you are expecting to have to duck because something's going to be some piece of food's going to be flying.
Yeah, you're like, let's walk into the cafeteria. I'm like, oh, great. Right.
Well, we got raincoats or something.
Because what I noticed is that they were all so engaged, like Katie was saying, in the process of eating lunch and serving each other. And so, you know, with kids of any age, it's like, if minds are wandering, that's when like chaos can ensue. And so it was like, not only was there like the process of things happening, but then there was also the tasting that was going on. Can you talk about the tasting?
Yeah, sure. So obviously, like, the fact is we can teach kids how to garden, and they can connect, and they could grow arugula and eat arugula dressing. But there's still this idea of introducing them to new foods that they've never heard of before. And how do we do that? We notice. Like, tofu is such a good example. I'm a huge tofu lover, so we used to put tofu on the menu without kind of the backup plan of how do we get kids to eat tofu. So what we started doing was we started forecasting what we were going to menu in the coming month, and introducing them to the ingredient, whether it would be raw or cooked in a, you know, in a specific way, to start the conversation about that ingredient, and to make it kind of fun. So we do a tasting, and then they all kind of vote, and they only get three choices. They could either like it, love it, or tried it. So there's no disgusting or hated it or any of those options. They could think that in their head, but we try to empower them with vocabulary, so they can make decisions and then kind of have opinions about it that are positive opinions. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, you could say, oh, I don't like it because it's too soft, or because it's too salty, or because it's too sour, because then we know what to do with that information, right? Uh-huh. We could adapt, or we can talk about it. We can further that conversation. So what we started doing is doing tasting, so they're introduced to the ingredient before it actually showed up on the menu. And we noticed that it just increased their likelihood of trying it and liking it, or even loving it, and, you know, in many cases. Were you there on chicken day?
It was sweet potato.
They were tasting sweet potato, but had like chicken drumsticks.
Okay. So you were, full disclosure. Yeah. Chicken makes everyone happy. Like, when chicken's on the menu, there's, I call it restaurant hum, right? Yeah. Like, the dining room kind of hums. There are definitely days where they're not throwing food, but there are definitely days that are a little more challenging, where they're a little less focused. You know, when I talk about this, I really always want to be real about this, right?
Sure.
Like, it is a continued, uphill battle, if you will, to get kids to eat everything you want them to eat. Mm-hmm.
So that's a good place to kind of take a break, I think, because when I come back, I want to get more into nitty gritty of like school lunches, because you mentioned one thing about milk requirements that I think is very interesting with school lunches. So when we come back, I want to ask you about what are the real roadblocks that exist in building a school lunch program like this, and like advice that you would have of then creative ways to get around the roadblocks.
Sure.
So we'll come back. We're going to refill our wine glasses.
Yes, we are. I do, just on the chicken thing, though, I do want to say, that doesn't mean chicken nuggets or chicken fingers. It's chicken,
it was real chicken
on the
with
bone. It was like chicken thighs on bones and chicken drumsticks on bones.
Yes.
Which is like so cool. And they could all totally deal with it. And I frankly know so many adults who cannot like eat meat on the bone. So anyway, just a little visual to leave you with.
Yes.
Think about
yes.
those chicken bones. We'll be right back.
Yes. We'll be right back.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. Did you find?
All right, welcome back to HR and Happy Hour. We're here with Frank Mentisana from EcoSpaces Education. When we left just a moment ago, we were talking about challenges that you have to kind of overcome when you're trying to reimagine and reinvent the school lunch program. One of the things that is kind of commonplace everywhere, it's a requirement, is that kids have to be given the option of milk at their lunch.
Because what bigger challenge is there than the U.S. government combined with the dairy lobby?
Woo! So on that note, I mean, first of all, talk about how you go about making sure that that requirement is fulfilled at Phillips.
Okay, I'm going to be as diplomatic about this as possible, right? Because there are some challenges, and some are real challenges, right? So at Phillips, it's interesting because in the beginning, we kind of decided we were not going to be part of the National School Lunch Program, which is the reimbursable meal program, because we wanted to kind of figure out how to do it our way and not have parameters that someone else was dictating. So we started this Made from Scratch lunch program. And as I alluded to before, this idea for me of sitting at a table around food is very powerful. I probably don't need to convince you guys, right? Like the idea of community around table and that power of community around food is really important. So inherent in the original design was to use round tables, to have 8 kids sit at a table and each kid have a responsibility to that table and mix up the grades, right? Like so typically you know, kids don't get to know each other outside of their own grades. And what better way to do that, if you're going to do it at all, is to kind of build friendships around food. So by original design, we decided that round table model was really important, and that each kid had a responsibility to that table. So setting the table, getting the water out, serving the food to each other, and then cleaning up and composting and all those kind of things. So that was kind of by design. Well, as you can imagine, that doesn't really work in typical cafeterias. So one of our biggest challenges was going to the USDA and the Department of Ag, who basically run the school lunch program, and saying, we have a different model that you might not be super familiar with in our, you know, in our space of education, but we've gotten it to work because we're educators and we taught kids how to do this, and it actually really works. So as we know, a traditional cafeteria line, you stand there with your tray, you get to the end of the cashier who rings you up and figures out if you get a free lunch or a reduced lunch or a full pay lunch. And that we just kind of said, we're not doing that. That's not the way we're doing that, because we believe so strongly in this idea of family style meals. So it took some time. It took a couple years actually for them to kind of come around and say, hey, what's going on? Like, what do you actually do? Let's look at this. So the other thing that was happening kind of simultaneously is that there was a whole farm to school or farm to cafeteria movement that was happening. And so just to tell you another challenge is 10 years ago, I could not get a farmer to deliver farm fresh food to a school. And I would say back then, or maybe 15 years ago, it was hard for even restaurants to do that, right? So so that's all changed a lot. So this was all happening kind of simultaneously, where we were talking about getting real food to cafeterias. So the conversation was happening and people were starting to listen. So again, that idea that there was alignment with kind of trends and what was going on, and people realizing that wow, if we support farmers through food in schools, we just gave them an entire market that really supports their lifestyle and their livelihood and so on. So there was a lot of that going on. So in the beginning, the challenge of not being able to get local produce was very, very, very challenging. And it was, we could hardly get anything. And that's changed a lot. We work with, Common Market and Zone 7 to bring, to bring fresh food from local farms to, to our program. So they started listening to us. So back to the lunch program. So they started listening to us, and they actually came in, and they're like, "Wow, you actually could do this." And it's funny that you clarified that the kids weren't eating chicken nuggets; they were eating real chicken. Because I remember when we got our first. So it wasn't an audit, but it was kind of what they call a pre-audit. So they come in and make sure you're doing everything according to their standards. And I remember the lead inspector speaking to her assistant, I guess at the time, and said, "They're eating real chicken." And I kind of looked, and I was like,
"What a word!"
I was like, "What do you?" Like, what do you mean? And it literally took me 5 seconds to go like, oh, they actually are not used to kids eating chicken off a bone. And they were amazed that kids were sitting there picking up the thighs or the drumsticks with their hands and eating it and, leaving the bone. So anyway, I think we've come a long way. And they allowed this all to happen. And there were definitely some things we had to do. We had to ensure, and we still have to ensure, that in these schools where we do family style, that the kids are giving themselves, when they're serving themselves, the right portions, the amount of greens, reds, blues, all of those colors that are necessary for a full plate. So yes, the dairy industry. You want to go there?
Let's do it. If you want to go there,
yes, we do.
I'm going to
briefly talk about it, but I'm not going to get too harsh. So the fact is, there's without getting into too many details, there's within the National School Lunch Program, there's like this idea of offer versus serve, and it's based on the five components of. Back when I was younger, the my pyramid. Now it's my or the pyramid.
My
now
plate.
It's my plate.
Yeah.
So the my plate. I'm relatively happy with my plate. Right. It's like. Lots of grains, there's vegetables, the animal proteins or the protein in general is not as big, but that milk is still there all these years later. And the fact is, like, we don't need milk. Like, once we stop breastfeeding, we could have a conversation about that, right? But the fact is, they want kids to drink milk. And in doing so, they ask us to support that initiative with offering two types of milk. Well, like, how there aren't, are there really two types of milk?
Like goat and cow.
Right. I mean, we could probably,
I'll give you a hint. They're not asking them to serve goat milk.
No. So in fact, I was like, what kind of two types of milk do you want us to serve? And they're like, well, chocolate or strawberry.
That's only one kind. That's sugar or sugar.
Yeah. Exactly. So my jaw drops. I'm like, okay, I think we could probably get away with this. What if we offered 2% and 1%?
Mm.
Ding, 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 we got it. And so we don't offer strawberry or chocolate milk. But the idea of that, of course, is kids will consume more milk if we offer them chocolate milk.
If we offer them sugar. Kids will consume sugar.
Sugar, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I mean, we know, like, the sodium and whole grain just got rolled back, right,
yeah,
today.
Yeah.
I don't know so we have to just keep plowing ahead and saying we kind of know what's right, and water's really good.
Well, is that, like, super concerning? Because, I mean, a lot of this work that you did happened during, under the Obama administration, when Michelle Obama took this on as, like, her mission.
Totally.
As the first lady. And obviously now you do not have the same Secretary of Agriculture. Like, things are very different. Are you seeing that having an effect on ecospaces or on school lunch programs in a way that, like, you're worried or concerned?
Yes and no. So I'm concerned because I watched Michelle Obama work really, really hard we all watched her, right?
Yeah.
For 6 years, I would say, she worked her tail off to to get Let's Move going, and there were lots of plans, and Sam Cast did an amazing job supporting, and you know, so on and so on. And there was a lot of alignment. Even corporations were starting to kind of listen and going, oh, we actually maybe have a sense of like social obligation to reducing our sugar and sugary drinks, or marketing different things like bottled waters or things like that. And so we've seen that. But we also saw by probably year 7 or 8 that she kind of started segueing towards, you know, issues around girls, mm-hmm. because quite frankly, she was getting pushback from day one. Mm-hmm. And that some of that pushback was against big government. Like, don't tell me how to feed my kid. Don't tell me my kid needs to eat whole grains because, you know, you're not the boss of me.
Ban my 7-Eleven drink.
Yeah, you know, so we have seen pushback. This is what I always talk about when I talk about our mission around ecospaces, is that the piece around school lunch, I'm happy to see a needle move, right? Like, I want to see policy, because it really only can work if policy changes, right, and systemic changes. So I want to see a needle move, because I personally can't change that, and my program probably can't change it. And when the First Lady can't change it, I don't know what else to do other than just plowing ahead and going, well, we're gonna do it this way for as long as we can do it. But the other piece of our program is independent of any big business or government policy and so on, which is we can get kids to garden in schools. We can get kids to cook in schools, urban farming. We can send kids to field trips. We have a program where we send kids to a farm in Vermont for 2 weeks. We can continue to do all those things. And when we do them with kids, they're eventually going to be able to make these decisions for themselves. And that's part of this whole system of empowerment, like empowering them to be able to make good choices for themselves. And then we also work with educators, and Food Corps is a great example, is, you know, every one of my Food Corps service members who's gone out into the world has stayed in this space, and they're eventually going to become the policy makers and the decision makers. You know, I have my original Food Corps service member is in Portland, Oregon, and she opened a garden-based preschool, right? So,
oh,
so
wow.
You know, that's amazing. I have two people in SNAP, in the SNAP Ed program. I have someone who works for Common Market selling farm fresh produce to, in a nonprofit setting to schools and restaurants and so on. So we're putting out potential leaders, or they're already leading. They're already in that space. So there's a lot going on. And then, you know, just getting to, I had an incredible meeting 2 weeks ago with 15 people from the Newark Board of Ed. And this is where it needs to happen. Like, all I can do is say, we can do this, but they need to be the decision makers. And next week, I'm excited. I'm actually having breakfast with the Brooklyn Borough president.
Oh, awesome.
So I don't know if you know his story, right? So
Eric Adams had an incredible self-transformation by changing his diet.
Totally.
That's going to be awesome.
So I'm having breakfast, I think at like this local diner somewhere, which is going to be kind of fun and very New York.
You'll have to tell us what he eats at breakfast.
Okay, I'll document it. We'll continue to do our work on the ground with kids and with teachers and with families, but we also need to continue those conversations with policymakers and borough presidents and mm-hmm. board of eds and those kind of things.
Yes. Well, Frank, we are coming down to the wire on subjecting you to our round of trivia, but very quickly before we jump into that, how can our listeners support Ecospaces Education?
Oh, that's, yeah. So, I mean, there's always financial support. There's a donate button on Ecospaces Education website, so that's surely one thing. I think continuing this conversation as much as possible, following us on Instagram and Facebook, we post really often just to kind of tell people what we're doing. We are not this year, but in 2020 we'll be producing another one of our Growing Healthy Communities conferences. That we've done twice already, and they're really for anyone. I mean, the focus is educators and school administrators who are kind of those decision makers, or who are on the, you know, kind of on the line with students. But that's clearly open to people. So
I hope you'll keep us posted on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what's the website?
And the website is ecospacesed.org.
Go check it out.
Thanks for asking.
Read all about it. Click all the social media handles and follow all of them.
Thank you.
One-stop shop. Okay, so we're going to do trivia now.
Okay, you know I don't like trivia, and I'm really bad at it, right?
No pressure.
But we're here to support.
Yes.
Okay, good.
So we decided we would... Pauline has put together our trivia for today, and it's inspired by the Once Upon a Tart of your past.
Ah, okay.
So we decided to ask you about a truly New York trend, hybrids in bakeries, mm-hmm. a la the Cronut.
Uh-huh.
And this trivia is also coming from Spoon U. Is that right, guys?
Yeah. So there's an article, which if you've read it, Frank, you'll have an advantage.
Oh, yes.
Okay. On Spoon University about hybrid pastries.
Okay.
So we just want to shout out and thank Alexa O'Connell for this inspiration.
So good. Okay. So the way this is going to work is I'm going to tell you the name of the hybrid and you have to guess what the hybrid is made of.
Okay.
The mashup. Mm-hmm. All right, so the first one is called a doskit.
A doskit. So it's a biscuit and a donut.
That's right.
All right.
Nice.
And that, well, okay. So moving on to the next one is called the Mallow Mac.
The Mallow Mac. So, Mallow Mac. Can I get a clue? Wait, Mallow Mac. Is it a marshmallow? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a hint. I guessed this one would be a marshmallow and Big Mac, which was not right.
That was my first inclination, but I refuse to say that.
Think of pastries.
A macaroon.
There you go. Oh, correct.
I want one of those.
Sounds good, right?
I think it's a... We were talking about this earlier in the office. I think it's a marshmallow macaron.
Macaron.
Oh, macaron.
Yes.
Oh, and I should say that that one is from Dana's Bakery Mac Bar in New York City. And the doskit was from In Grain Restaurant in Chicago.
Ooh,
in case anyone wants to track these down.
In case you cannot live another day without a doskit.
I can't. Okay.
I'm out of here.
Next one is called a scruffin.
A scruffin.
This is Katie's favorite.
Shudder.
So it's not an app. So it's a muffin and a scruff.
I'll give you a hint. The R is misleading and misplaced.
It's a superfluous R.
Hmm.
Should really be called a scuffin.
Yeah, it should.
It's a scone and a muffin.
That's right. You're killing it.
Which sounds honestly just like a really dry, heavy muffin.
Yeah, exactly. Although we used to have people, I mean, back in the day, people were like, can you just make your muffin tops? Which exists now.
That does exist now.
But 26 years ago, it was a novel idea.
So there was a long-standing demand, and someone finally decided to fulfill it.
It's good to know the muffin top is occasionally in demand.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, next one is called a bruffin.
A bruffin. So is it a... burrito and a muffin?
You're halfway there.
It's a muffin for bros.
Yes.
Yep. It's a savory one, and the first part of the word refers to a type of sweet bread.
Oh, I remember.
It's a brioche
yes.
and a muffin.
That's right. Yeah. And guess who serves it? The Bruffin Cafe.
Of course they do.
Get me out of here.
Here in New York City, so go check it out.
They have different flavors.
Wow.
Oh, yum.
It sounds kind of good.
Tomato bruffin sound delicious with a little like Gruyere and an egg in there.
Right? Mm. Seriously.
Okay, so this last question, I'm going to tell you the name of four hybrids, and you have to figure out which of these four is not real.
Okay.
We have... the Duffin, the Townie, the Pookie, and the Churon.
I hope it's the Pookie.
The Pookie is real.
It's real.
And it is a pie and a cookie together.
Oh.
Your voice sounds happy, but your face doesn't look happy.
Because, you know, you try to get these flavor ideas in your head.
You're like, kind of digging that.
Yeah, exactly. What was the first one?
The Duffin. Duffin, Townie. Pookie Churon.
Okay, I'm going to guess the Townie.
That's also real.
Oh, man.
Okay,
so
the Duffin is a donut muffin mashup.
Okay.
The Townie is an American brownie with a European tart. And then the Pookie is a pie and cookie. The churron is churros and macaroons, but it is not real, and it is from the TV show Broad City.
Oh, it'll happen tomorrow, right? Somewhere out there in bakery land.
Yeah. It might have not been real.
For now.
Now it's real. Right. Probably real. Exactly. After it appeared on the show.
Search the dark web. I'm sure it's out there.
Maya, Broad City ended last week, and it was so sad.
I'm not ready yet.
I love that show. Pauline, thanks for putting our trivia together.
Good work, everyone. That was a tough one.
Thanks, Pauline. I was a little stumped.
Frank, it is our pleasure to inform you that you've won trivia.
Yay!
Congratulations.
I feel good.
Thanks for playing. And thanks, everyone, for listening to HRN Happy Hour. It's been a wonderful Thursday.
Frank, we'll come back anytime.
Next week. I would love to.
You're welcome here always.
Lots of food stories.
Yeah. So
please send up your updates.
So much for having me. It was
all a right. Thanks, Amanda, our engineer. Thanks, Pauline. Thanks to Katie.
Thanks, Kat.
All right, that's our show. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.